What's up, my friend? It is ADHD Coach Catherine here with this week's episode of ADHD Powerful Possibilities. And because this week we celebrate International Women's Day on the 8th of March, I decided that the whole of March I want to focus on the way that ADHD affects women and girls. I am delighted to have some amazing guest episodes this month, and I want to say, if you are somebody with an XY chromosome, please don't feel excluded. You are also going to find lots of value in these episodes because ADHD does not discriminate. Although we still have a diagnostic ratio in childhood which is far from equal one-to-one, boys and girls, we know that as we get older, the ADHD that is present in girls becomes more noticeable as we go through life. And so the things that I talk about in childhood and puberty, you will recognise as a man or a young man. And when you go into parenthood, many of the challenges that affect women as they become parents also affect men, but we have the added bonus of hormonal dysregulation on top, which, yes, does affect our ADHD. And so I don't want you to feel excluded, but I do want to say this is specifically going to be looking at the social, emotional, neurobiological impact of ADHD on women and girls. And I'm not going to apologise for that, because for decades we were told that we couldn't have ADHD because we had a job, we had a degree, we were managing to keep our homes running, we were doing all of these other things, and yet ADHD has been shown to affect women throughout their entire life, and this is only really being discussed now. So it might feel like that's all you ever hear right now, but that's because it's really important we catch up, we become educated, empowered, and we share that knowledge with the people that live with us and around us. As always, you will know that there are going to be practical strategies and things that you can take away and put into action right now at the end of the show. So don't worry, I'm not going to spend the whole episode talking about inequality and inequity and all of these structural injustices that people face if they're neurodivergent. But let's look at ADHD in young women and girls. My story is that when I was young, I was a dancer. I was obsessed with ballet. And at one point, I think I was doing 4 or 5 dance classes a week, every single week. Bless my parents for having the patience to take me to them all. But if your child is hyperactive, but is using it in a more acceptable way, are you actually going to notice if they're hyperactive? I remember, looking back now, being told by one of my grandparents to stop fidgeting, to sit still, to sit down. I didn't sit still. And yet, if you'd asked me in my 40s, I would have said, no, I'm very dreamy, daydreamy. But looking back, I recognised that there was an area where I was definitely hyperactive, definitely unable to sit still and very much driven like a motor. But I was dancing so much, and it was the 70s, so we walked everywhere. We literally didn't have a car for many years. So physically, I was very, very active, and that, I think, helped a great deal. But would I have been diagnosed with ADHD in my childhood? Probably not, because my hyperactivity was socially acceptable. When we look at babies, we don't think about them having ADHD or autism, really. It's rare for a parent to notice something immediately. I would say, as a parent, that I noticed the difference within a few months. That's not my story to tell. But if you think there is something different, and if you've got other children who are different and who you can compare your child to, pay attention to what you're noticing. Keep a record of it if you can, because it will be useful later on. At the moment, the diagnosis seems to be that more girls are inattentive presentation. Let's be clear. There are 3 presentations of ADHD: combined, inattentive, and hyperactive. There are no 7 kinds of ADHD. There are no types of ADHD. It's one spectrum of a neurobiological, mostly genetic condition, which changes the structure and the neurotransmitter soup, if you like, in your brain. It's also going to affect the rest of your body because our brains are not completely separate from the rest of our body. But if you have an ADHD brain, it will be different from birth. We just don't notice it so much. Round about the toddler age, parents start to notice developmental differences. And we know that children with ADHD are delayed in some areas between 3 and 5 years. So you may find that your child gets, in quotes, stuck at a certain stage. They are not emotionally keeping up with their peers. They are still more prone to having meltdowns or unable to focus for the same length of time. But at the same time, these are toddlers. And so I'm completely in support of the medical community who do not want to diagnose very young children with things like ADHD, because there is a wide variety in terms of our development as humans. And although I don't think we should be pathologizing normal childhood variation, I do think it's worth bearing in mind that there will come a point where our traits, our symptoms, will start to get in the way. And that's unlikely to be in academic terms. It's more likely that your social and emotional skills will be impacted before anybody notices that academically you are struggling. And we may think of ADHD as being a behavioural challenge, and that's where it shows up. We know it's a brain-based difference, so that's why it affects your social cues, your skills, your ability to maintain friendships, your ability to connect with other people, to manage your emotions. Although I am passionate about helping young people and supporting them and their families with practical skills, with learning how to scaffold their school days, their study when they go to university, all these things are important. The most important thing to learn is the emotional and social skills, the friendship skills that are often missing. Because the recent study in Attitude, which I will link to in the show notes, showed the devastating impact on the mental health of young people, particularly young girls with ADHD, when they are socially excluded and they don't see how fabulous and precious and wonderful they are. So thinking about our brains and the ADHD brain in particular, what happens when these children, especially girls, go from being younger children who are maybe inattentive, maybe a bit hyperactive, a little bit distractible more than their peers? What happens and why is it so much worse when they enter their tweens and early teens? Well, they're already facing differences in their prefrontal cortex, which affect things like our impulse control, our focus, our attention, our decision making, and all of these affect our daily life, especially in the realm of friendships and social connection in childhood and in learning. We also know that young girls and boys with ADHD have differences in the level of dopamine and how dopamine is regulated in their brain. They have extra efficient dopamine transporters. They have lower levels of dopamine production. They are chronically under-rewarded, which is why they may be a little bit more challenging when it comes to things like wanting toys, wanting rewards. And it's why things like reward charts are very inefficient for kids with ADHD. And we also see differences in brain scans for girls with ADHD and boys in terms of their functional brain connectivity, especially in networks that are related to attentional control and inhibition, that being able to pause before you do something. And quite often I've seen, especially with young children with ADHD, they know they shouldn't do something but they can't stop themselves. If that continues past the stage that you would expect it to have stopped, there's a little flag for you to keep a note of when you go and speak to somebody about ADHD. But the real kicker is when progesterone and estrogen are introduced into an ADHD brain. where the science is very new. It's still not completely agreed that this is what's happening. We suspect, I say we as if I've got anything to do with it, I'm a coach, not a scientist. The scientists suspect that ADHD brains are more sensitive to estrogen and progesterone and testosterone. So it makes sense in that context that when our own bodies start to transform from the age of 9 upwards, the impact on your brain is going to be significant if you have a neurodivergent ADHD brain. And of course, all of this is happening at the same time as they are looking at a move from, in the UK, we call it primary school education, where you have one teacher all day in one classroom, to secondary school. In the States, it's junior high, where you have different teachers for subjects. You go from room to room. And while you're doing that, you're meeting new people and your body is changing rapidly. So I want to leave it there for now in terms of puberty, but I hope you can see that even in childhood, these young people are facing significant challenges in terms of A, people recognising their neurodivergence, and B, being able to access that support. Let's take a look at the social impact of ADHD on girls, because I think this is something that we're only really discussing in the popular press now. The social impact of ADHD is massively underestimated. The pressure on girls especially to conform, to meet certain standards, to have a certain form of behaviour, a demeanour, is so strong now, even compared to 15 years ago, before the introduction of social media, that I think we're facing a group of young girls with ADHD who are going to need massive levels of support to challenge those norms and to be safe and well in themselves. Whenever your young girl with ADHD says something that is not expected, behaves in a way that is unacceptable, is unable to prevent themselves blurting something out, forgets a social norm or nicety, basically when their disability impacts their day-to-day life, they are going to be judged mercilessly by their peers and, sadly, by many adults. And of course, these children are aware that they are being judged and that they are found wanting, which creates more problems because they become emotionally dysregulated. And when your brain is trying to decide if you're actually about to be attacked by a bear, or that girl in the corner is giving you the stink eye and is going to say something mean about you, you're not paying attention to what's going on in class. You're not able to retain information when you are under threat. And I see young people who are under threat from the minute they leave the house and until they fall asleep. It used to be until they came home, but the impact of constantly being available should not be dismissed. Because the other thing we know is that bullying and social isolation and risky behaviour are much more common in girls with ADHD. And the earlier these girls experience social isolation and bullying, the more likely they are to have mental health problems as adults. And that includes anxiety and depression, which is often the first thing that a doctor sees. I'm not bashing doctors at all. They face a very difficult job. But if a young woman comes in, a young girl comes in, and they're anxious and depressed, it would be worth thinking, is there something else in the background? And I'm going to include a link to the Attitude study from a couple of years ago, which was based in the States, but which showed clearly the devastation on the mental health of young girls with ADHD from both social pressures, from academic work, but especially from online community. This is talking directly to young girls with ADHD who are maybe in their tweens, who are feeling really isolated right now. There's nothing wrong with you. You're wonderful. I wish you could see that. And even if you are feeling isolated and you don't have any friends and you're not sure what you're going to do with your life and things are confusing, I promise that you will get through this. You will find your people. You will discover your strengths. You will shine. And whatever the adults in your life can do to support you, I will help them to learn. And this is if you are a parent or a grandparent or an aunt or an uncle or a cousin of a young person who is suffering right now with this isolation, the emotional dysregulation, the real challenges that I'm seeing day in, day out in young people with ADHD. You can make a difference. You individually can transform that young person's life. If you are looking after a young person with ADHD, they've been told they have anxiety or depression, they may have an eating disorder because these start incredibly young these days, girls 8, 9 and 10, I would ask you to very carefully do a home screening, one of these self-assessment forms, with your young person for ADHD and or autism. I will include links to free ones that you can download and do at home, then take to your GP. If you suspect your young person is neurodivergent, you can start to put things in place before you get a diagnosis, before they get medication, before they get any kind of school-based intervention, because they are depending on us to do the work, to be the scaffolding, to provide the framework, and that is our job. Because while we wait for assessments and medication, their emotional life, their academic life, their social life is suffering. And the longer we delay, the worse it gets. And there are two or three people, especially in the UK, that I will include links to, who are fantastic for this. I'm thinking of Square Pegs and other people who I will link to below. What are the things that we can do as parents, as educators, as family and friends of young girls with ADHD to keep them safe, to help them live a better life? And what can we do right now? Number one, build up their self-confidence. I'm not a fan of self-esteem, which relies on comparing yourself to other people. So self-esteem to me is too fragile and risky a strategy for girls with ADHD and adults. Think about their self-confidence and how you can foster that at home. That doesn't mean you do everything for them. I'm not suggesting we wrap them up in cotton wool. Instead, identify their strengths, their interests, their passions. If they have a skill for something, what opportunity can we give them to push that, to enjoy it, but also to become more proficient, more skilled? If a child is competent and skilled in one area, the more we can allow them to flourish and develop that at their own pace, the more their self-confidence is likely to build. This isn't about overly praising children for nothing. If you're going to praise your child, it needs to be very specific and it needs to be based on their effort rather than the outcome. And I do think you can offer constructive feedback, but I would phrase it instead of saying, that is a fantastic Lego sculpture. I think next time you could do this. I would change the last part to, how would you change it next time? Or would you change it next time? But how would you change it next time allows them to think, oh, I could do even more next time. Build up their self-confidence as far as you can without being inauthentic and fibbing, because they can smell that a mile off. Second thing you can do is help them to cultivate self-compassion and self-regulation early on. Self-compassion is about being kind and accepting and loving towards yourself. It means being kind and understanding in moments where we think we have failed or where things are difficult. And it's the difference between saying, oh, I'm so stupid, I can't believe I did that, and, oh, this is really difficult, I might take a break and come back to it in half an hour when I've got more energy, or, wow, this is really difficult, I'll keep trying for a bit longer. But without that judgment that we very often carry around. And for parents, you can model this, because I hear you, I've seen you, and you are very, very tough on yourself. When you model self-compassion, that is the voice that your child will use for themselves. when your child is struggling, when you are struggling, use the self-compassion technique of acknowledging that all humans struggle. It's part of our shared experience. It's part of being alive, and it's normal to find things difficult, to fail, to make mistakes, and we are still worthy of love and acceptance. That in itself is going to promote resilience and reduce isolation. And you could create a really supportive and accepting environment. That might mean that your house has to look a little bit different. It might mean that you have a kind of flexible seating arrangement so that if you've got a young girl who likes to be fidgety and dancey and is hyperactive, they have the space to do that, or you're at least understanding why they're doing it and not telling them to sit still and sit down. They are allowed to be themselves within boundaries at home. And if you're in school, there are ways that you can structure your class, structure your day, so that kids who need breaks, kids who need stimulation, kids who process information differently are supported. And the same thing at home, it means everybody benefits. As an example, I know that I need visual information. I cannot process auditory information at the same speed and I can't retain it. So if you need to have whiteboards, have one at the front door, have one in the kitchen, wherever you are, so that you can record that information, normalise it for the young person involved. And advocate for yourself and for them to have the accommodations that they need early on. Even if they don't have a diagnosis, there are things that you and the school can do that do not require vast sums of money. Just take some time and a bit of flexible thinking. And although neurodivergent people are often told that we're very rigid, I have to say that in my experience, quite often, there's an institutional element of this is how it's done that speaks to me of a real rigidity and lack of flexibility when it comes to doing what young people need in that moment. The next thing you can do is empower them with knowledge. There are some great books about ADHD in girls. I would go to the one by Patricia Quinn and Dr. Kathleen Nadeau, these fantastic trailblazing women in the forefront of ADHD in women. Go to them. They have books about ADHD in girls, and understand them and yourself, and don't feel like you have to give them a lecture about it. Drop it into conversation as you're going around. If something happens, you can say, oh, well, that's okay, that's normal with ADHD, because our working memory is a little bit more challenged, especially if we are upset. It doesn't need to be more complicated than that, and you don't need to watch a TV series or go through a book with them, unless they are interested. If they are, have at it, as long as it's one that focuses on the strengths and the possibilities that come with ADHD, as well as understanding where we need to add the scaffolding. This means that when they go into a setting outside the home, they're going to be more able to communicate what they need and advocate for themselves. And I have to say, I have seen young people who are so able to express what they need that the adults in the room actually didn't say anything because it was so clearly expressed and so reasonably asked for. This is what I need because I don't understand when you do this. It's much easier for me to focus when the class is like this, when there's something on the board and when the teacher's reading it out. I need both of those. We need to empower them so that they know what they need and they're able to ask for it in a way that most adults, not all of them, are going to accept and be grateful for, because they want them to succeed as well. And finally, the next thing you can do, and one of the most important things, is to understand that coping strategies need to be personalised and share with that young person what they need. Allow them the space to be able to identify when something works and when something doesn't. So if you have spent a fortune, and this is not me personally, but I have seen it, if you have spent a fortune on stim things for young people, whether that's chew things or fidget toys, and they don't touch them and they keep using the clicky pen, that's okay. they maybe need a stim toy that has that level of noise, that has that particular action. And we need to say, that's okay, that's what you need. Allow them to notice and then record it with them in a way that they can access later. Things that can help a lot with personalised strategies are social skills groups, and there's some debate around whether these are actually encouraging people to mask. I personally think if a child chooses to engage in a pro-social behaviour so that they can make friends, that's okay, as long as it's their choice and we're not asking them to not be themselves. We're sharing the knowledge of how this other group of people communicate, they can opt in. So social skills groups, executive function coaching, which is something that I do, and of course CBT or DBT, which is something I don't do because I'm not a therapist or a psychologist. It's worth exploring what works for them at different ages and different stages, because the social skills element, I think, is the one that is really missing and is crucial. And I have a few bits and pieces I'm pulling together for that over the summer. And the reason that they need to know their personal needs and their personal strategies is because it gives them a sense of autonomy and agency. These are fancy words for saying that they are in control. They are the people who know themselves best. Just from a safety point of view, it's really important that all children know that and they're able to see what they need. And hopefully those needs will be met by the adults around them, whether that's family, carers or in school. Because when we focus on self-confidence and self-compassion, we're maybe not creating young people who are going to be mini geniuses and get top marks in school. We are helping young human beings to form a core identity of worth, of healthy self-concept and genuine resilience, so that whatever happens, they know what works for them, what they need, and they're able to ask for it, and they know that their worth is beyond what they are putting out in terms of productivity or academic results or social validation. As usual, in the show notes, I have linked a lot of academic pieces that I think are valuable, are relevant, and I've included the books that I think are most useful. But if you have a girl with ADHD, the number one thing I think that you need to offer is acceptance, support, and compassion. And you need to offer that to yourself and show them how to do it. That means children do what we show them, not what we tell them. So we might talk about compassion and acceptance. If we're not walking the walk, they will ignore the talk. That's my number one suggestion. And just love them. Just love them with all their amazing differences and the things that make them fantastic fun to be around. I absolutely love kids with autism and ADHD because they are so interesting and fun and unique. And I hope that you can enjoy that and celebrate that with them too. Next, we have got a special guest episode with Dr. Kathleen Naddo, and we have got next week a look at the transition between school and university, early adulthood, from teens through to early adulthood. It's going to be an absolute cracker of an episode, and it's after International Women's Day. Until then, please take care of yourself. Go out, and I hope it's springtime where you are and you can see the spring buds and the flowers coming up, because it is making my heart sing. If you've got a little girl who's what I call a fireball, or maybe somebody in your family does, share this episode with them and make sure they know that you see and value their young girl. From one team bulb fireball family home here to yours, take care of yourself. Until next week, I'm ADHD Coach Catherine. Remember to stand in possibility.